for the two of you who are fresh to the experience today, what we have been doing, we're looking at our experience from a number of different skillful means. And the one that we will start with and the one that we will make reference to throughout is the arriving sequence. And this is a preliminary practice. It's an establishing mindfulness in terms of the Dhamma, not just establishing mindfulness as a orientation like you could do in any situation. You could, the Venerable Sumedho will say that the person who sneaks into your house while you're sleeping in the bedroom and takes your computer off the kitchen table is being very mindful, but that's not the Buddha's mindfulness. So I think that's something for us all to keep in mind. The Buddha's mindfulness is part of an eightfold path, and that's the fourth noble truth, to find it. And in that regard, the Buddha's mindfulness is towards liberation. And going that way through having an ethical base and called sila, and a generosity base called dana. And the generosity involves everything from giving people the benefit of the doubt to helping people, to having many of the qualities that that we all admire in people. And that generosity is in the context of the ethics. And then there's a bhavana aspect of the path, which has to do with our becoming, our gaining insight that allows us to be more empowered to choose what? To choose non-suffering over suffering. So these aspects in that way. And I emphasize the wisdom aspect a lot, which is in the first two of the Eightfold Path, which is wise view and wise intention. And I have been really interested in that. And yesterday, the third part of the Eightfold Path is wise effort, mindfulness, sati, and samadhi, the concentration. We did a lot of collecting and unifying the mind yesterday. We will do some of that today. We always need to be renewing our commitment to having a mind that's collected and unified. But yesterday afternoon, we started watching ourselves in relation to compulsions. And that was insight. That was for the purpose of insight. And again, the insight is for our empowerment. So we have choice. Choice is a very big word in the way I teach. Choice or choosing, the ability to choose, empowered choosing. If that somebody told me, which I'd never heard before, that they had always had trouble with me calling it choice, because choice meant it had political words and all of that to them, and it never crossed my mind. So choosing, if that's a better word for you, this empowerment that you know that you have, you are entitled to choose, that you have the power to choose. You can gain this empowerment that allows you to choose how you're relating to your experience, and that you that it can be cultivated, and it is cultivated through practice. And what we are doing, we are discerning rather than judging, comparing, or fixing. So you've heard me say over and over again, particularly when I first get to the physical body, that we're not judging the body, not comparing the body, not fixing the body, because those are all reactive states where we're finding the moment unacceptable. But the whole Buddhist approach is to choose to be in the moment as it is. And then from being in the moment and having not just your view about the moment based on all your conditioning, based on your habits of mind, but you actually employ discernment because you can have a felt sense. This is another big part of the way I teach, is I emphasize the felt sense, because this is what I do in my own practice. So I'm simply doing with all of us what I do in my own practice. Not much changes, actually. You're kind of, it's like I'm practicing and you're going along as much as you like with it, which may be very little or a lot. That's all up to you. And so we looked at compulsion, which I described in relation to the first and second noble truth, that the first noble truth is that there is dukkha. And we talked about the three kinds of dukkha briefly, the dukkha, I term it, physical pain, emotional pain, the plane sitting on the tarmac for 2 hours before it takes off. That's dukkha. It's just dukkha. And dukkha is not a mistake in this realm. Dukkha is part of this realm. You cannot have sukha, that happiness, that sweetness, that satisfyingness, without dukkha. It wouldn't make any sense as a construct. It'd be a whole different construct if there was only the pleasant, only the satisfying. It would be different. This realm is not set up that way. And the Buddha says that it's very fortunate that it's not set up that way, and to be a human being living in this tension of between sukha and dukkha and having to find our own way. And coming from C.G. Jung's work, I call that the tension of the opposites. And I think that the Buddha understood the tension of the opposites long before anybody else did. And we're still only now catching up with the Buddhist psychological insight. And others will say that there is no psychological insight, and it's all about liberation. And if you have psychological insight, it's selfing. That may be true. I don't quite view it that way. I view it that it's inevitable, that because the Buddha tried all sorts of things along his way, and he also gives all sorts of teachings that are very psychological from my point of view. But that's just a subjective point of view. But nonetheless, to know it. And then let's see, what else would I want to say? So the compulsion, that there's the title of this retreat is about seeing the way the outer experience and the inner experience we have. An outer experience is that what we experience through our five senses and the mind itself about what we think we're experiencing. And so, like, we can be having a smell that we don't like, that smell, or we don't like that taste, and that's an outer experience. We're being verbally attacked, or we're being ignored by or denied something that was actually our right, and we're not being given credit for something at work that was ours. It was our work, and you know, the supervisor just took it and presented it as theirs, and all of these kinds of things that happen all the time in the world. A person repeatedly parks in a way it blocks the place you're supposed to park your car. That's dukkha. And so those outer experiences are what they are. And we can have compulsion in those outer experiences. Well, compulsion can arise in relation to the outer experience. But then our inner experience can be so different than the outer experience. Someone is very unfriendly to you at work, and you kind of lose it over that. But if you really sat down and, well, what's my inner experience? You go, that person means nothing to me. I am falling into my outer view about, oh, this is really important, but it's an unpleasant person. And you can imagine their suffering, you know, that going around being unpleasant to people. There's a lot of suffering in that. So you start to be able to separate your inner experience from your outer experience, and therefore your sense of well-being, your sense of purpose, how you're receiving life starts to be quite different. Quite different, and because you're more in tune to the inner experience, and then you see where the inner experience has delusion in it, has you, and you start to see that where your own inner greed, you've been really going after something in the world, and then you really realize actually that was my greed, that wasn't that my greed. I was having an inner experience, you know, and that was causing me to be like this in the world when it's really not appropriate, or I don't even care that much about this. I got my conditioning led to this, and then my greed got all of the one who never gets credit, or the one who never, it's never their turn or whatever. And so your whole inner experience is, you know, it's just a job. It doesn't hold up when you look at it from that perspective. So you can see how inner compulsions are where we're caught in some way, when we are clinging, that in the second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering, and that is tanha, thirst. That is that we have grasping, clinging, ideation, and so on. So forth, and that, and starting to see that, we see that it's where choice is, dukkha is going to happen, and that the dukkha of the first noble truth, all of those things are going to happen. But where our freedom lies is in how we relate to that, and do we have choice in relation to when things are. Disquieting and physically, emotionally, when there's the uncertainty of a Nietzsche of change, which is the second, and then likewise with the lack of a sense of we can't really find who we are, you know, that's why we cling so desperately to who we are. It's not the nature of our nature is different than it first appears, and that takes a long time to sort out for each of us. And we do learn to do that. We learn to not have our compulsions in that way. And compulsions is a word that I'm using to capture the felt sense of how it is when we're clinging, when we're grasping, when we're attached. So often the feeling, there's an energetic feeling of a compulsion. I've got to have this. What will happen if I lose this? All of that kind of thing. And I can't be here. I can't stand this. And it gets, we're compelled to try to get out of that situation. But then actually, if I just sit here with that piercing pain in the shoulder, what happens next? And it turns out that there's a wider range of experience than what our reactive minds are understanding. We are compelled when we're in a reactive mind. When we are not in a reactive mind, that we are in a responsive mind. And a reactive mind is based on pleasant and unpleasant. It's based on how we are conditioned to interpret something. And it's based on what we've been taught to believe. It's not very individuated. It's not, to use another C.G. Jung term, it's not we've not really found our own. What is our true experience? And we've not gotten used to just seeing, but then how actually is this? What is this really like? And when we gain more and more of that ability, which we do by sitting, you know, in the fire of accountability in relation to our experience, we then have this ever-growing responsive relationship with our experience. In reactive, when you're reactive, you are all defined by what's happening. When we're responding, the same thing's happening, and it's definitely characterizing the moment. Nobody's disputing that, but it's only characterizing it. And so moving from reactive to responsive in the teachings I do is liberating right there, because you have choice. You have choice. And you can stay true to what most matters to you. And of course, in a Buddhist practice, it is about choosing non-suffering. It's not, it's finding more and more choice to not be called in greed, not to be called in aversion, not to be called in delusion. More and more and more, we're able to do that. And so another word I use a lot, which I may or may not use later today, is relatedness. And one way to understand the Four Noble Truths that I've never heard anybody else teach, but nonetheless, we can understand it all in terms of relatedness. How are we relating to our experience? And because we're all relating to one another, we're relating to the environment. How responsible we're being environmentally. That's how we're relating to the environment. It's a relatedness. It's got this. What word would I use? The typical Buddhist word is co-arising. We're like in this reality, in this moment, we're co-arising. Every one of us. Our experience is co-arising. And even people that you can't see on the screen, they're part of this co-arising. And Thich Nhat Hanh uses this beautiful phrase of that we enter our, and meaning that that we are not separate from one another. I meant to look for, and I haven't found it yet, there's a wonderful Einstein quote saying that we have the delusion of being separate. And it's not true. This is Einstein, a hidden Buddhist, a hidden Buddha maybe. There's a wholeness. The retreat we're involved in is a wholeness of interconnected teachings as we get exposed to this kind of an interconnected teaching, it becomes more and more you create your own version of that. What's important to you and what keeps you on the Dhamma path, and there's a series of grounds that we'll talk about maybe more this afternoon, but we are grounded. We have a ground in which to stand. If we don't have a ground, then we're flopping around in the wind, you know? So the worldly winds blow one way and we flop one way. If they blow the other way, we flop the other way. And there's not a sense of, there's no here. There's not that lack of this. And that's what we gain. That's what we gain through our practices. That we have a ground in which we're experiencing. We have a wise view as to what life is about, and we have the intention. This again, a practice of intention as to what matters, and we're going to manifest what most matters. And we do that in relation to goals and means. So goals are whatever we want. We have goals for our work life. We have goals for our home life, for our relationships, for taking a hike, for keeping our body in shape, or whatever it may be, staying healthy, or being a good friend. You know, we have goals. Ideally, those goals are truly based on values. Even something that might seem not so value-based. Oh, I'm walking up the mountain with a friend. That is interlaced with values. First of all, were you considerate? Are you being considerate of your friend? So maybe your friend is not able to walk as fast as you, and are you pushing them too much? Because you want to get up there at sunset, you know, so that you can see the sun going down in the ocean. And in doing that, you're not being skillful. Or your friend, what your friend most needs right now is to actually tell you something. And you're so busy in your goal that you, that you, that you don't miss it. And that's why, so we have goals that are wholesome and unwholesome. And then we have means that are skillful and unskillful. We all know about unwholesome goals because everybody on this, in this community right now, that's on the screens, you're old enough to know if you've had, you've made it your unwholesome goals. And we're, if we're lucky, we have fewer and fewer unwholesome goals, but we probably all still have some of those because of our ignorance, of the kind of fundamental ignorance of misperception. That's why the Buddha so emphasizes ignorance. It's not a labeling. It's understanding that we don't know, and how, and that's why don't know mind is so important. Is if we start with we don't know, we're less likely to assume we know, and therefore double down on our ignorance. And then so we start with that, and then our means can be skillful or unskillful. And so goals can be skillful and unskillful. We learn to get more and more skillful goals. And then more and more we're interested in, okay, is this skillful means? So you may like getting your way. That's an examination itself. Am I compulsive about getting my way? And it's an examination, but it's not a judging. It's not a comparing. It's discernment. It's so important that you get this. If nothing else you get from this whole retreat, that you understand the difference between judging and comparing and fixing, and then that between discernment. Discernment can look like judging and comparing because you are employing this, the capacities of the mind examining. But discernment leads to wisdom and compassion. Judging leads to creating a self. Comparing leads to creating a self. And fixing, it not only creates a self, it can create its own compulsions. They all do. We compulsively judge, we compulsively compare, we compulsively fix. And these are so subject to insight, so subject to our getting clear in our values, what really matters to us. And so we can actually, with not having to change our personalities can cause ourselves and others a lot less suffering. And that's why all of this is worth it. That's why it's all worth it. It's why it's worth it for my time to be doing this, is this empowerment. That is my satisfaction as a teacher, is your empowerment. I am a practitioner who teaches. I'm not a teacher who has a practice. Very clear on that. And I did not really have any interest in being in this role, but it all unfolded the way it did. So I've gone with it. But it's very important. And you missed yesterday also that we practice practice. We're not practicing results. In our culture, this is very difficult to accept, to even being willing to consider. It's very, very difficult. You watch these kids, you know, doing their various sports things, and you know they shoot a basketball 1,000 times, or swing at a bat 1,000 times, or tennis, or they on the dance, or all of this. They're practicing practice, and the practicing practice is what empowers us to have those characteristics that over time lead to results within the set of characteristics we have. So we're practicing practice. The other thing that I so emphasized yesterday was the importance of having humility, this humility of that we don't know. We get very defended if we feel like we know. We get so defended. It leads to compulsion everywhere. And the defendedness that we can have an outer experience where it's all about out there that we know, or it can be inner that we know. You know, either way, we could be in this knowing and defending our knowing that we're right and so forth. And it's compulsive. It's really compulsive. There's not choice. There's not like, well, so if what would be the other person's point of view here? Like, well, what if I don't get this? What is, we don't have the space around it. And so we're very interested in that. And I'm going to stop here because I could go on and on with this. But I've done the list this way because of the surround. This is a surround. This is at the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodhgaya. It's a beautiful temple where the Buddha, we were told, got enlightened. And the Bodhi tree, a successor of the original Bodhi tree, is there supposedly. And but you circumambulate it. That is part of your honoring, your feeling the presence of all this long sangha this time. And but there's little small statues of Buddha everywhere, some not so small. I don't know how many. I never tried to count them. But in our lives, you could understand that we are circumambulating our lives, or we are circumambulating all the different Buddhist teachings, our understandings, and the different aspects. Lots of different ways, but that we, so this totality, that this is a series of practices that are all interconnected, and the reason they're all interconnected is because I'm teaching what I have learned from my practice and what I've learned from my teachers, and they're all connected because I've spent all these years connecting them. And therefore, you can find anything that I say and any other thing I say if you just track it back through like that. And I've done that as best I could because that was the way I was taught, that with all the Buddhist practices, that they really, that it's a hologram in that way, you know, that it's any one piece really contains the whole things. I'm not saying that about what I offer. I'm not the Buddha, but I have sincerely and honestly and assiduously worked hard to make sure that that as best I am able, that my view, my everything is that way, because I don't know. You know, I'm motivated by that. The other things was around integrity and dignity, that we don't have those words much in our society now. But that was one of the things people remarked about the Buddha, and but we can definitely have a whole new, fresh experience around our integrity and our dignity, and have an understanding of it that we did not have. It's not about following the rules. It's integrity and dignity are much more subtle than that, and much more encompassing of the whole experience. So humility and dignity and integrity as the way we walk the path. And with that, we'll go to our first sit.